Good morning, and welcome to the Court of Appeals by Zoom. Our next case this morning is, I hope I pronounced this correctly, the State of Minnesota versus Armarte, case 820-0045. As all parties are aware, counsel for the appellant will have 15 minutes for their argument in chief, counsel for the respondent will have 15 minutes, and then counsel for the appellant will have 5 minutes of rebuttal. So whenever you're ready, counsel for the appellant, just begin and just unmute yourself and tell us who you are, please.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Gina Schultz. I'm an assistant state public defender, and I represent Jonah Armarte, the appellant in this matter. There are two issues before this court today. The first is whether the district court abuses discretion in denying Armarte's motion for an alternative placement under Minnesota Statute Section 609.1055. The second is whether the district court's imposition of two consecutive sentences unfairly exaggerated the criminality of Armarte's conduct. Because the answer to both questions is yes, this court must reverse and remand for resentencing. As a preliminary matter, there can be no real dispute whether Armarte suffers from a debilitating mental illness. Not only does he have a long history of civil commitments and hospitalizations and other psychiatric interventions, but every person in this case who has interacted with him has expressed concern over his mental health, from the police officers who interviewed him, to the staff at the jail, to his public defender and the Rule 20 examiners. While the case was pending, Dakota County successfully petitioned to have him indefinitely committed as mentally ill and dangerous. The evidence of his impairment is everywhere in the record, except in the district court sentencing decision. Whereas here, there are mitigating factors present, the district court is required to carefully consider them. But the record indicates that the district court did not do that here. While there's no requirement for the district court to make findings or explain its decision, the district court told us exactly what it was thinking, and it did not even mention Armarte's mental health. So moving to the specific issues raised in this case, his schizoaffective disorder was relevant in two ways. First, his diagnosis made him eligible for alternative placement under Section 609.1055. Armarte litigated this issue, arguing that his civil commitment to the Minnesota Security Hospital satisfied all of the requirements of that statute. And the district court did not even address that argument.
Well, Ms. Schultz, the statute says that if he does meet those requirements, he may be eligible, but there's no requirement that the district court place him there, correct?
Correct. Under the terms of the statute, there's no requirement that the district court grant such a motion under the terms of the statute. But here there was an abuse of discretion when the district court denied his motion. First because it doesn't appear that the district court carefully considered this argument, as was its obligation.
What evidence do you have that the district court did not consider the facts when it denied its motion? And I mean, just because the district court doesn't go into detailed explanation, the fact that the district court denied it, we have to assume that the district court did its job and did consider those facts.
Well, Your Honor, the district court did explain its decision here. The district court mentioned the victim impact statements. It mentioned the facts of the offense. It explained his decision at some length, but it didn't even mention his mental health diagnosis. And here, where Armarte's entire argument hinged on the fact of his mental health diagnosis, and this court's case law, the Supreme Court's case law, the sentencing guidelines, and the Minnesota statutes are clear that where diminished capacity for judgment is a factor that's present, it has to be considered. And here, even looking at the departure report that the district court filed after sentencing, because the first sentence was a slight downward durational departure, the district court did not even indicate that mental illness was a factor in that decision. There's no evidence in the record that the district court thought about that at all. And here, where it is such a strong mitigating factor, that is an abuse of discretion. There's no way for this court to even review that decision. Where
it was, so the first sentence was a downward dispositional departure, and the second sentence was within the guidelines. So the district court is not required to provide any rationalization for sentence that is within the guidelines, though.
Right, but I'm just saying that because the first sentence was a downward durational departure, the district court was required to submit a departure report. And on that departure report, the district court just indicated that the reason for the departure was that it was recommended by prosecution and the plea agreement. And here,
Ms. Schultz, I will say this is slightly different than the argument I read in the briefs. I mean, I'm well aware of those cases where, you know, if the court specifically didn't consider something, you know, there's or ignored it, you know, there might be an argument there was an abuse of discretion because the court didn't even consider it. But I really didn't get that flavor from your briefs. I got it was more like, well, you know, he's mentally ill and he should have been committed to a facility. Where is this argument in your brief that the court didn't even consider a possibility, you know, that the whole sentencing hearing was about, which is, you know, he has serious mental health issues? I'm looking at it now. Where would I look for that?
I don't know if I can get you the exact page number at the moment, but I know it is at the end.
Maybe just think about it for rebuttal. You know.
Sure. I know that it's at the end of the section addressing the 609.1055 issue.
I guess my other question is, and Judge Reyes touched on this, I mean, at the end of the day, there were two victims, right? And permissive this is permissive consecutive, which is not a departure, correct?
Correct.
Okay. So everything depends on your evidence that he should have been committed to the mental health facility. I don't know if I like the responses, but apparently, you know, they do have, you can get some mental health treatment in prisons. I mean, you know, I'm not going to kid myself that this is some, you know, like going to Mayo, but I mean, the court suggested that there's some evidence that the court did think about that. So therefore it was cognizant of the mental health issues. So what are we supposed to do about that?
I don't think there is evidence that the district court really considered it carefully. But your point about the permissive consecutive sentences, that goes to the second issue. And there is a limit there. I mean, this is not the presumptive disposition. The presumptive sentence is concurrent sentences within the appropriate box of the guidelines grid. And here there's a limit on permissive consecutive sentences, even where they're allowed under the guidelines. And that's that they're not allowed where their imposition unfairly exaggerates the criminality of the defendant's conduct. And here, I know there's not a lot of guidance in the case law, but there are examples of appellate courts stepping in and saying this was too much. But I think importantly here, I think the case of State v. Wall is instructive, because in that case, we've got a similar defendant with a history of mental illness with psychotic symptoms who committed a similarly horrific crime. And in that case, the district court imposed an upward durational departure based on the particular vulnerability of the victim. So that had nothing to do with the defendant's mental illness. And the Supreme Court reversed that departure, saying that even if there are grounds for an upward departure where the defendant has, where it clearly has the mitigating factor of substantially diminished capacity for judgment at the time of the offense, it's just not appropriate. And I know we're dealing with different standards here between permissive.
I mean, but that case was one victim, right?
The case was one victim, but I do think that it's analogous in the sense that there we're looking at an upward departure, which is permissible under the guidelines if it's supported by substantial and compelling reasons. And here we're looking at permissive consecutive sentences, which are permissible under the guidelines if they don't unfairly exaggerate the criminality of the defendant's conduct.
Well, but the district court directly address that. The district court highlighted the victim impact statements that were made in court. The district court indicated that the night before went through, I think it was 21 letters that had been submitted as well, and even indicated on the record that not having consecutive sentences would diminish the impact that he had by taking not one, but two lives, and that it would be appropriate for him to receive a sentence for each life he took, and went into great detail about that. So how is that an abuse of discretion by the district court? I'm really struggling with that argument there.
Well, it's an abuse of discretion because those facts, although they are true, they don't relieve the district court of its obligation to carefully consider his diminished capacity as a result of his mental illness.
Well, but to that point, there are two issues there. One is that that issue had been addressed very early on in determining whether or not he was competent to proceed to trial. Now, I realize that doesn't answer your question completely, but also when you look at the PSI, that indicated that there were no mitigating factors, which would include diminished mental capacity at the time of the offense. And you had two of the doctors who said he did not have diminished capacity at the time of the offense. So in a way, that issue had been addressed up front, but the PSI also did indicate that there was actually one possible aggravating factor by him not offering assistance to the victims, which the district court did again address at the time of sentencing as well.
Well, I guess two things, Your Honor. First is that there's a difference between not satisfying the not guilty for reason of mental illness defense, which is extremely demanding, and meeting the requirements for a for a mitigating factor under the guidelines. And if the district court determined that the record doesn't support mental illness as a mitigating factor, that's an abuse of discretion. That is contrary to logic and the facts in the record. It's undisputed that he is extremely mentally ill. He has been for decades. Even if he didn't meet the requirements of the McNaughton test, I don't see how you can read this record and determine that he was not operating under a diminished capacity for judgment. You would have to assume that this offense was completely unrelated for the fact that he was decompensating psychiatrically, that he had this history, that he had all these triggering events that exacerbated his symptoms, that he qualified for indefinite commitment as mentally ill and dangerous. I don't think that's logical to assume that his offense was completely unrelated to those factors and that he's culpable in the same way that a neurotypical defendant is.
Ms. Schultz, there are certain types of decisions that a district court makes where the district court's required to show its work. So for example, if the district court elects to impose an upward departure from the sentencing guidelines, the court is required to state the reasons on the record. It seems to me you're arguing in part that the abuse of discretion here was the court's failure to consider the mental health issues as a basis for a downward departure, but there is no requirement for a district court to sort of show its work in rejecting a request for a downward departure. Would you agree with me about that?
I do agree with that, but I think the abuse of discretion is obvious here because the district court did show its work. The district court explained exactly why it made the decision that it made, and it didn't mention mental illness once. And I think that is completely out of step with the record, where his mental illness was a significant concern for the entire case. And so one of two things happened. Either the district court didn't carefully consider mental illness as a mitigating factor, or determined that it was such a minor factor that it didn't need to factor into its analysis.
But and Michelle, I hope I don't sound like a broken record, but I think the district court, I think you do agree with Judge Gaitas that if in terms of downward departure mitigating factors, the district court does not have to explain that. So we don't have to look for something there in the record. But even if we were to look for something in the record, I mentioned the testimony of the doctors earlier when they found him competent to stand trial. They noted that he, at the time of the offense, he didn't seem to be, there's no question that he has mental illness issues. But they indicated, they testified that he did not, was not under dealing with those mental health issues at the time of the incident. And furthermore, the district court did touch upon that from my understanding when he indicated that he didn't offer assistance, he fled. And one of the things that the doctor testified and the PSI indicated is that he knew the wrongness of his actions at that time, which would lead to the idea of culpability because of his actions then. So it seems like the district court actually did consider that from my perspective.
I see that I'm out of time. Would you like me to save my answer for rebuttal?
Yes. Okay. Yes, please, Ms. Schultz. No, answer it now, please. Thank
you. Okay. I guess I do agree with you that there's no obligation for the district court to show its work when denying a downward durational dispositional, but I strongly disagree with the fact that the district court had already determined whether he had a diminished capacity for judgment. There's a reason that the mitigating factor exists when the not guilty by reason of mental illness defense exists. It's that if you don't qualify for one, you can qualify for the other. It is a lower standard. And in terms of the potential aggravating factor of not offering assistance after the fact, I think under Wall, it's not appropriate to impose an upward durational departure where there is a significant mitigating factor related to mental illness. So we would ask this court to reverse and remand for resentencing.
Thank you. And you will have 5 minutes of rebuttal, Ms. Schultz. Ms. Light, if you just give me 1 second, please. Thank you. We'll now hear for counsel for the respondent. You will have 15 minutes. Please go ahead, Ms. Light.
Thank you very much, and may it please the court. My name is Anna Light, Assistant Dakota County Attorney, and I represent the respondent, State of Minnesota, in this matter. As Ms. Schultz explained, there are two issues before the court today, and I think the conversation so far has kind of combined the issues a little bit, so I want to make sure we talk about them separately, because they are different and they have different standards. The first, with the motion for alternative placement, that is a motion for a dispositional departure. And the guidelines are very clear that the presumption is that the guidelines will be followed. Conversely, with the consecutive sentences, in this case, it's a permissive consecutive sentence that is not a departure from the guidelines at all. So I think that's a point just to be made and for the court to be aware of in the analysis. Turning to the motion for a dispositional departure, I think it's very important that the guidelines say that the guidelines must be followed unless there are identifiable, substantial, and compelling circumstances to support a departure. And even when those circumstances exist, the district court still retains its discretion to impose a guideline sentence. And that's exactly what this court did in this case. I think there's been discussion about the appellant's mental illness. And, you know, I know I in no way want to minimize the importance of mental illness in our criminal justice system. But I think when looking at a departure under 609.1055, there's two considerations. First is the serious and persistent mental illness. And the other is public safety and making sure that the sentence imposed by the criminal court is in line with public safety. And in this case, the record is clear that the district court considered both the appellant's mental illness and what the impact of this sentence would have on public safety. And so as the court has discussed, the district court does not need to explain its reasonings for denying a departure and imposing a guideline sentence, but the record is clear that the district court did consider the motion for a departure, the reasons for a departure, and came to its decision after careful consideration. The prosecutor in the sentencing hearing highlighted his mental illness and discussed at length what kinds of services he could receive in a correctional facility versus the secure hospital. So the court heard all of that testimony, heard about the appellant's diagnosis, and so that was part of its consideration. In addition, you know, talking about public safety, and I think the district court on the record considered and made a record regarding public safety that the nature of this offense is horrific. It's an intentional murder of two people, and that this murder was committed despite the appellant receiving mental health treatment in the past, having the protection of civil commitment in the past. And at the time that he committed these offenses, he was receiving a mental health support through his probation officer and mental health case manager. And he was also prescribed medication at the time. And despite all of that support in the community to help him and to remain stable, despite his mental illness diagnosis, he committed these murders. And so in this case, a commit to the Commissioner of Corrections was appropriate, and the district court did not abuse its discretion in doing a guideline sentence.
So Ms. Light, you seem to indicate that hearing the testimony from both parties was enough for us to conclude that the district court did consider his mental illness issues, and particularly the persistence of the illness. But the record is pretty replete that this is not a one-time incident in terms of his mental illness. He's had a long history. So would you agree that element certainly is met here?
I would agree that it's persistent and that, you know, that it is a serious mental health diagnosis. However, I would also point the court to the record demonstrating that, you know, in other ways, he was functioning in society and in the community and, you know, and not needing hospitalization prior to this incident. So I think the record is complex when it comes to the severity of his symptoms at the time. But I don't dispute that he had a persistent mental illness.
So, I'm sorry, Judge Riss. Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
It sounded like you had a follow-up.
To your point on the record being complex, we did have a third doctor who testified that he was not in the right frame of mind at the time of the incident. And we also have the transcript of his testimony, when he was interrogated. And it seems pretty clear he was not making a lot of sense at that time. And so, I mean, there seems to be a lot of evidence, as Ms. Schultz pointed out, that he was not in the right frame of mind at the time. So while there may not be any explicit requirement that factor be discussed, it seems that when you've got emotion and you're talking about the illness there's no indication that of consideration by the district court on that issue. And that why shouldn't we reverse on that issue?
I think as you indicated earlier, we presume that the district court does its job, and its job is to, you know the record, review the record, listen to the testimony, consider all the arguments and make a decision. You know, I'd point to the to further the complexity conversation, you know, also in the record, the day before he committed these murders, he met with his mental health case manager and his probation officer. And both of them indicated, while yes, he was experiencing stress and mild symptoms, he in no way needed any kind of psychiatric intervention at the time. And then also after he was arrested and gave that interview, because law enforcement was concerned about his mental health, they transported him to the hospital. The hospital did a psych eval and discharged him straight to the jail the same day. So that shows that they, the you know, psychological experts, the medical experts deemed that he was stable enough to reside in the jail versus needing acute hospitalization at that time. And that's you know, in the moment surrounding the incident.
Ms. Light, so you mentioned at the outset of your argument that the district court essentially had a couple of considerations here, one of them being public safety and the second one being Mr. Amarte's mental health. And I'm wondering whether it would be an abuse of discretion for the district court to only consider the public safety and impose the presumptive sentence, or was the district court under some obligation to also consider the mental health component?
I think the district court was under an obligation to consider the motion for the departure, and the motion was pursuant to 609.1055, and the criteria for that is both serious and persistent mental illness and consistent with public safety. So I think the district court, it was tasked with considering both of those components. But as we've discussed, the district court has no obligation to state its full reasoning on the record when it's imposing a guideline sentence. So I think we need to look at what the record contains, what was available to the district court at the time that the district court was making its decision, and presume that the district court was making a full consideration when denying that motion.
So in other words, the district court would have been within its discretion to conclude that the interest of public safety was paramount to the two considerations identified.
Yes, I would agree with that. Moving to the consecutive sentence issue, as I mentioned, so the appellant was convicted of two counts of second degree intentional murder, and these are eligible for permissive consecutive sentences under the guidelines, and that this is not does not constitute a departure in any way. And so as the discussion was earlier, the court will only interfere if there's a clear abuse of discretion, and only if the sentence is disproportionate to the offense or unfairly exaggerates the criminality of the defendant's conduct. And so here, neither of those is true. Here, two lives were taken intentionally. He was found competent to proceed in his criminal hearings, and two out of the three court-appointed psychologists found that he understood the nature of his conduct and understood the wrongfulness of his actions at that time. And so, and when we look at other cases dealing with multiple counts of murder, and even where mental illness is a factor and is a concern, the appellate courts have consistently upheld consecutive sentences in cases similar to this. You know, I'd also note that the state and the state could have requested, and the court could have imposed an even lengthier sentence. But in reaching the plea agreement, the state considered all of the appellant's circumstances, including his mental illness, including his remorse, including his pleading guilty, and requested a downward durational departure on count one, reducing the sentence that he actually could have received. So in this case, you know, that really shows that this sentence really serves the purpose of the sentencing guidelines, is consistent with the guidelines, and was certainly not a clear abuse of discretion in this case. Unless there are any other questions, I just conclude by saying that the district court acted within its broad discretion by imposing the presumptive disposition and permissive consecutive sentences in this case. And we respectfully request that this court affirm the district court sentences. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Light. Before we begin, Ms. Schultz, I just want to have the marshal, get the thing on 5 minutes. We debated all day whether to use a cell phone or the clocks, and I voted for the clocks, and now I remember why I didn't like to use the clocks. While he's doing that, I guess I'll let you talk, but I did have one question, so I'll let you begin. Thank you. Go ahead, Ms. Schultz.
Thank you, Your Honor. If you have a question, I would be happy to start by answering that.
I'm looking at the transcript from the sentencing hearing, and because Judge Reyes and Judge Gaitis have touched on, did he really consider the arguments that were made at the contested sentencing hearing about his mental illness? And at one point, the judge said, while in the custody of the commissioner, you will have access to any programming, medications, counseling, or whatever else you may require. If the Commissioner of Corrections feels it needs to transfer you to the custody to the Department of Human Services, the state hospital in St. Peter, then that they can and have done that in the past if they are not able to provide the services you need. I mean, that seems to me proof positive that he considered the alternative and said no. So why am I wrong?
Well, Your Honor, I guess I disagree in the sense that I think being aware of his mental illness does not mean that it was factored into the district court's decision. And I think this probably is especially relevant for the for my second issue, which is that it is clearly a mitigating factor. There's no way to argue that it's not a mitigating factor, and it just didn't factor into his decision. The district court told us exactly what it was thinking, and it didn't talk about it. I understand that, he was aware of the fact that he could be transferred or he could get certain services, but there seems to be a disconnect between this kind of broad agreement that he has a debilitating mental illness and any awareness that it affected his capacity for judgment. It is absolutely true that at least two of the Rule 20 examiners decided that he concluded that he didn't meet the not guilty for reason of mental illness defense, but one of them did. The record is complex in a certain way. It's a complex in the sense that it's unclear whether he would have been able to prevail on a mental illness defense because he decided to plead guilty instead of pursuing that at trial. But it's just not complex in terms of whether he had a mental illness that was affecting his decision making, whether he was completely debilitated in the sense that he, didn't know where he was, didn't know how to, didn't know what he was doing. It seems clear that he had at least some awareness. But that is a different question than whether he had a diminished capacity for judgment. And I think it's just absolutely clear that he did.
But Ms. Schultz, to Judge Connolly's point, which I think is a good one, you're arguing that the district court abuses discretion by denying his motion for alternative placement. But that statement seems to me to clearly indicate that the district court actually did consider alternative placement, and looking at the two said, no, I think you can meet your needs with the Commissioner of Corrections, but if for some reason they cannot, there actually still is an avenue for you to have alternative placement. So that seems to be a pretty clear indication that the district court not only considered that factor, but also looked at the fact that that alternative might actually come to pass.
Well, even if that's true, Your Honor, I think it it doesn't change the fact that it was not considered as part of the permissive consecutive sentencing. And
right, but that's the second sentence. So I think we need to be clear. And I think Ms. Light made a good point that there are two separate issues that are being raised here. And your argument there seems to go explicitly to that first issue.
I guess I still stand by my argument, Your Honor, that when the district court explained its decision, it didn't mention, it didn't address his argument at all. It did notify him that he had, you know, some possibility for treatment or interventions in the future. But I just don't think there's any record that the district court really carefully considered it as an option. And I want to briefly touch on the point of public safety and whether the 609.1095 issue was consistent with public safety. And here he was committed as mentally ill and dangerous to the Minnesota Security Hospital, which is an extremely secure environment. The OLA report, there's really no difference between it and prison in terms of security that's consistent with public safety. I see that I'm running out of time, but I would ask this court to reverse and remand for resentencing.
Thank you. If you had a final thought, Ms. Schultz, you wanted to make, you know, I took up a lot of your time. So if you have a final thought, you can have 30 seconds.
Thank you, Your Honor. I cited the OLA report in my brief, and what it says is that once you're committed as mentally ill and dangerous, that's a lifetime thing, unless you can convince the Special Review Board and the Commissioner of Human Services that you're safe to return to the public. And that's rare. A full discharge is extremely rare. And even a provisional discharge, again, you would have to convince DHS that you are a board of professionals that you're safe to be in the community. And even then it would be with heavy supervision and whatever conditions the district court would choose to impose. And any violation of those conditions could lead to the execution of a sentence. So I believe that it was consistent with public safety. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Schultz. Thank you very much, Ms. Light. We are well aware of the seriousness of the issues at stake in this appeal, and we appreciate the thoughtfulness of the arguments that were made. Our decision will be released within 90 days. Thank you.
Thank you both.